Little shout out to my sister. She's turning 64 and listening from California with my brother right now. And if she's missing this moment, you know, serves her right. Just saying. You must be mic two. Try that again, Kelly. No? What mic could you be on? I'm going to just hit mics on until you start. There you are. I bet you're mic four. Good to see you. I'm Catherine Lake. Thanks for tuning in to 720 WGN. I forgot the name of my radio station briefly there. It is Thursday night, right?
Thursday night.
It's beautiful weather, but somewhere in this city, there's some crime going on. There's something going on, and we're going to figure it out. And maybe we'll figure out some of the things that have already happened. But that's why we're here today. I'm Catherine Lake, as I said, and Kelly Richmond Pope is somebody you may have already heard of. She has a podcast, first of all.
I do.
She has a doctorate in forensic accounting.
In accounting.
Mm-hmm. And you've become a professional forensic accountant in your development as a professional. Is that right?
Sure. Well, I teach a forensic accounting class.
Okay.
So that's part one of the classes that I teach.
Just one of the many.
One of the many.
One of your best ones, probably your most favorite class to teach. Is it?
Don't tell anybody.
I won't. The other classes, I'm sure, are fascinating.
But I think that forensic accounting is like the mixture of all accounting. So it's auditing, psychology, sociology, criminology, and your basic accounting course is like all mixed in one. So
it doesn't have to be criminal forensic accounting. It could be, what happened to this company? I wonder why it went belly up. Is it that too?
It could be, but a lot of times it's criminal.
It's about crime. I feel you. Okay, so we're going to talk about a lot of different things. And if you want to get in on this, please do call 312-981-7200. You can also text. You can confess by text if you like, because we're going to get into that as well. But one of the most interesting things that you have done is to investigate, not only just investigate, but also create a documentary about the woman in Dixon, Rita, who took $53.7 million from the city of Dixon because she was the comptroller.
That's right.
She made the deposits. She collected the money. She decided where it went. She was a one-man band.
One-woman band.
One-woman show. And she walked away with walked away, not so much now.
Well, for about 20 years she walked away.
She was at 20 years that she did it.
Yeah.
Over a 20-year period.
It's a long time.
And over 20 years, the effect on the city of Dixon must have been monumental. Losing $53 million to somebody some other way. Right?
Sure.
As a matter of fact, I watched the documentary today, I will tell you.
Okay.
And I have family in-laws from the Dixon area, Sterling. And Sterling came into the story, too. Sterling in Illinois, because the comptroller of Sterling, from what I understand from your doc, tried to tell Dixon, it's funny, you know, we're sort of similar. We don't have the problems you guys do. I wonder what's up there. How did that transpire?
Well, the city manager was preparing for a meeting, one of their city council meetings, and realized, you know, let me pull some information, and was looking at the fund balances of the city of Sterling and comparing it to Dixon, and noticed that they were just out of whack.
Out of whack. They should be somewhat in the ballpark.
They should be similar, which is a red flag when
right.
they weren't.
Right.
And a gentleman wrote a letter, went to Dixon, and saying, what's going on? Like, why aren't we looking the same? And so that's how Sterling came into the story.
Okay, Sterling came into the story, but it didn't start the real ball rolling of catching Rita. And her last name again, Rita?
Crunwell.
She was not caught by Sterling raising a flag.
Oh, no.
It had to be one of her coworkers who did it.
Well, it was actually Kathy Swanson. Kathy Swanson was a whistleblower, and she was the city clerk for the city of Dixon and reported to Rita. And actually noticed that there was this account that she had never heard of that had these deposits and withdrawals coming out of this account. And she wondered, like, what is this?
So is that how she did this? Rita did it. She created a special account, didn't have it part of the system, but made it part of the system that could receive direct transfers from the city of Dixon's accounts?
Well, so the city of Dixon had six accounts.
Six, okay.
With Fifth Third Bank. And then Rita created a seventh account that she only controlled and only knew about. And just transferred money.
Just
from
moved it over.
Yeah. It was a very simple scheme.
It really wasn't it?
Just moving money.
And she kept copious notes.
Well, you need to.
You do. When you're doing this stuff, you got to know where and when and how to explain it.
Yeah, you think about if you've I know that you've never told a lie, Catherine.
Never,
but if you did, you sometimes need to keep track of the lies that you're telling. And yeah. So it makes sense that she would keep really great notes, because to run a town and to run this massive horse operation and to just have your own personal life, you have to keep all this together. So it makes sense that the notes were pretty well maintained. In her basement.
In her basement. That's where they went eventually. So she goes away on vacation, and oddly, she allows this woman who is the whistleblower to find some information, because she had to get some statements sent to her to accomplish something, and she started to investigate. She got the mayor involved, didn't she?
Yeah. So Kathy was doing her job, and in her job discovered that this discrepancy. And when she found out, she let the mayor know. So a lot of times frauds are discovered just by mistake, just like how you just stumble on it.
Can you imagine if she's just looking at those dollars and coming and going and thinking, this is odd, but I don't want to say it's odd to my boss, my friend, my comrade in 20 years working together. She had no idea what this was about, and she mentions it to the mayor. I was surprised he didn't say, oh, whoa, let's call an accountant, let's call the police, let's get this rolling. He said, okay, let's take a breath. Let's make a phone call. Let's figure this really out. And then he went to the FBI.
Well, really what he wanted to do was to make sure what he saw or what they thought, what they were seeing was real. Because what you don't want to do is be wrong.
Right.
You don't want to accuse someone of something that egregious and you're wrong. So they wanted to just make sure that what they were going to accuse her of is actually what she was doing. So that's what they did. And then once they felt like they had a solid story, they went and contacted the FBI.
Who immediately knew they were right. You got this right. We have this problem here, and we're going to jump in here.
Yeah.
How long did that investigation take? When the mayor called the FBI to, oh, you're going to go to jail.
Well,
give or take.
It was a 6-month process.
6 months or so. And it was secretive. I mean, they really didn't, they didn't tell her at first. They didn't go to her right away. They started just,
well, yeah, I don't think the FBI lets you know that.
No, they don't call, do they?
They don't call and say, we're looking into you. Just hold tight for a second.
Just
we're looking.
Give a sec. Don't hide anything.
Don't go anywhere.
Don't change anything. Don't shred. No, they figured it all out. Well, we're going to talk about this and a whole bunch of other things having to do with true crime. As a matter of fact, Ashley, who, by the way, is producing us tonight. Hi, Ashley. Thank you for being with us.
Hello.
She'll be answering the phones and helping you out if you decide to give us a call at 312-981-7200. Ashley said, ooh, when I saw it was true crime, I was all in, because you watch programming of true crime. It's fascinating, isn't it?
You get sucked in, and it really is like a rabbit hole. You're just like, oh, I want to research this after you watch the documentary, and you want to see if you can find out more, and you figure it out. It really is so fun.
And that is true. You put together an entire documentary on this, Kelly. Really impressive work.
Oh, thank
That's
you.
Really, and was it a misery to do? It was hard. It's challenging.
I didn't go to film school, so I went through a program sponsored by Cartemquin Films called Diverse Voices in Docs, which was a 6-month fellowship program. I feel like it was my third PhD, but I learned everything that I needed to learn to take on a project like this. So I had some really great people that I was able to work with. And
big team, a lot of cameras. I mean, it looked like it. It was really impressively done.
A lot of different cameras, a lot of different people. It was about a 5.5-year project. So
get out. So this ended when? When did the Dixon? I mean, I remember hearing about her, but I don't recall what the time frame was for her 20-year excursion through the finances of Dixon.
So when did the film project end, or when did her
reign end? How
her
long
reign
ago?
Ended in 2012.
12. Okay, it's been a little while then.
Yeah.
So in case you haven't remembered this is the woman who had 400 horses?
Yeah.
She got up to 400 horses, showing them. How do you even begin to show 400 horses, by the way? Is it breeding and hanging out and I don't know much about horse breeding.
We need
breeding.
Some horse collars to come in.
We do.
Yeah. If you know of quarter horses, call us and tell us how do you breed quarter horses.
What is a quarter horse for that matter? I don't know the difference between quarter horses and other horses. I think it's
the distance that they run on the track.
Oh.
And then they're big and stocky. So they look like the muscle horses.
So they're racers or they're not racers?
They run short distances.
Short distances. Okay. Okay.
It's like sprinters.
Like sprinters. Yeah. Okay. All right. So she had a whole bunch of them. Okay. Somebody can help us out. Well, we'll continue on with this. It is Catherine Lakin with you tonight with Kelly Richmond Pope. She is a doctor of accounting.
Yeah.
And several other degrees. I'm sure that I can't even remember all of them. But we'll learn more about that and take your calls as well. 312-981-7200. Illinois DCFS under attack. What's gone wrong and what's being done to put things right? Protecting children, examining DCFS this week on WGN TV News at 9. It's true crime on WGN Radio. It's Catherine Lakin with you, with my guest Kelly Richmond Pope. All night long, we're going to be talking about true crime, things that you shouldn't have done, but you got caught. Or maybe you didn't get caught, because I do want to talk to some people who do crime, who have, you know, just gotten away with something here and there, maybe just cheated a little bit, maybe they
just
lied,
a little bit, right?
Just a little bit. We'll have a couple of those later on tonight. But right now we're going to start with All the Queen's Horses, which is the name of the documentary that Kelly Pope put together about the woman in Dixon, Rita
Cronwell.
Cronwell, can't remember her name to save my life. I think it's on purpose. She embezzled, as you know, $53 million, almost 54. Unbelievable. And spent it on herself, on 400 horses that she wound up getting her hands on. Just an astronomical amount. I mean, the documentary talks about what she spent it on and how she upgraded that van of hers, that big trailer.
Yeah, her motor coach. She had to travel to the horse shows.
That itself.
In style.
Up to $250,000 just for that damn bus.
Well, it ended up getting into the millions. So.
Did it really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's just where it started.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, that's a hell of a bus. How did you get involved in true crime? What made you really get into this? Because you started out, like you said, as an accountant. You probably got a bachelor's and thought, well, I like numbers. Maybe I'll get a master's. I'm going to keep going here. Then you get into the PhD area and you start teaching and then you get into true crime.
Well, I started teaching an ethics and international accounting class years ago at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And I started really dabbling into how we think and how we reason through decisions. And I had a student that did a paper on forensic accounting. And I said, that's what's interesting. I like how it combines all these different aspects of accounting. And so when I moved to Chicago and started teaching at DePaul, I started teaching the graduate forensic accounting class. And so I wanted to show students that crime is all around us, fraud is all around us, but we can use accounting to help figure those crimes and help make the world a better place.
Whether it's financially based or not, it can lead to information about other kinds of crimes too,
well,
I suspect.
It can. But you know what I've noticed, and even in the when I watch Netflix and a lot of the movies, even when there is a story about a relationship, someone was murdered, oftentimes it goes back to a money situation.
Yeah, right.
So there's always that money piece. Mm. And so that's where your accounting comes into play to help figure out, you know, how the numbers are telling a story, because numbers tell stories too.
Well, and as we talked about in the first part of this hour, this woman in Dixon was caught. The comptroller was caught embezzling this because she took great notes. She kept great records. And this seventh special accountant to which she transferred $54 million, she had it all written down. It's just a matter of following the trail, right, for the
sure.
FBI? And the motivation for that, though, that was really interesting. You said that you were fascinated by the motivation for people making decisions that they make, and that is including bad decisions.
Sure. And I really started wanting to make class a lot more interesting. So for some reason, students don't always like their accounting classes.
How silly.
So I started bringing TV and movies into the classroom and said, you know, I could probably make one myself. I could do this.
I could do that.
You know, famous last words. Cause it was a lot harder than I thought it was.
No,
I mean,
kidding.
Famous last words. But I was going around the country and doing these on-camera interviews with whistleblowers and victims of fraud and some white-collar offenders. And I would bring that content back into the classroom and show students, like, look at this story. You know, and what are the internal control weaknesses that allowed this crime to happen?
Oh, interesting. And they talk about that a lot in Dixon.
Yeah.
You know, they changed everything.
Yeah. So it just really made the class more lively, and students really understood why these principles that we're learning about are so important. So that's how it all really started, like bringing some outside content into a traditional space that's unexpected. So
what's one of the things that was unexpected that you learned about why people decide, you know what, I think I'm going to do it. I'm going to take this thing. I'm going to steal this thing. I'm going to embezzle this. With that moment where they make that decision that it's okay, or that they need it that badly, or that there's some other justification, what else did you learn about that?
Well, I think what I found most interesting is just how trusting we are with the people that typically handle our money.
Ooh.
And we're often not comfortable talking about money. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not comfortable.
I was raised not to.
Yeah. Right, right. And so you're also raised often not to question the person that manages it. So we're very trusting. We're even trusting with the bank. The bank sends us, this is what your statement is. How many of us balance a checkbook anymore? If the bank says you have $50, you have $50, you just accept it as is. Mm. And so it seems even when you're managing millions of dollars, we're still very trusting of that person. Just like they were trusting of Rita, and just like we often are trusting of any person that's our treasurer or our finance director. We love them, we trust them, and we give them a lot of power. So that's what I think I learned through the Dixon process and doing the film, just seeing how people trusted her so much.
And the other side of that coin, the person who finds the error or the crime or whatever it is they find as evidence that something may be amiss here, a whistleblower, that's something I really want to get into, too. How do you finally come to that place, that space, Kathy, for instance, in Dixon, when she said, this doesn't smell right, and this is my friend. She didn't know her really well, right? Not close friends with Rita. Kathy and Rita were not close friends, but they were
work friends.
Work friends for 20 years. That moment when she decides, and you even asked her in the movie, are you a whistleblower? Yeah, I guess I am.
But I don't think she went into it saying, guess what, today I'm going to be a whistleblower.
Yeah.
You know, she did, just like a person doesn't say, today I'm going to steal.
Right.
She didn't wake up and say, today's the day I'm going to be a whistleblower.
She kind of stumbled into it. But then she made the decision to follow up and to make a change, you know.
Well, what's interesting about Dixon is Mayor Burke, the late mayor of the city.
He passed. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he passed away. But I think he weathered the storm and really took a lot of the, he became the mouthpiece. Mm. So Kathy discovered it, but it seems as though Mayor Burke was the person that really did all the interviews and was a spokesperson.
He got a lot of trouble for that too, from the city, right? They took him and the whole city council to task. The city did.
Well, the residents. Sure. They you know, they're asking for accountability, you know. But it's interesting because one of the things that I wanted to show in the film is you had the auditors, you had the bank, you had the commissioners, and you had the residents. Everyone played some type of role, not the same role, but it's not just, you just can't point your finger at the other person. You sometimes have to point the finger at you. What were you doing?
So the auditors, Clifton, Larson, Allen.
Yes.
They stepped in after the fact, or were they the auditors all along and should have been more accountable?
They
so
were
speak?
Their auditors throughout this process. But one of the things that we like to say in class, audits are not designed to find fraud. They can, but they're not designed to do that.
What are they for?
Well, they're to tell you that the financial statements that were put in front of you by management are correct or not correct. But we're not looking at every single transaction to say, okay, this number is right, this number is right, this number is right. We're like taking a random sample of transactions to say, we're looking at this sample, and based on the sample, we don't think there's any errors in a larger group.
Glaring, huge, big errors, right.
So,
kind of missed this one.
Yeah, they did.
Did they get in trouble? Are they still in existence?
What do you call trouble?
Lose some clients, first of all, for sure.
That I don't know. I would imagine that some of their clients probably said, maybe we should think back and maybe we should look at a different firm. But no one went to jail.
No one went to jail. They're no still one. Open as far as you know.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, it's fascinating. Again, I'm Catherine Lake. We're with Kelly Richmond Pope here. And she is the documentarian as well as a doctor of accounting at DePaul, but the documentarian of All the Queen's Horses, the story of the woman who stole all the horses that she could. 400 horses she bought with $53 million, and along with a whole bunch of other stuff. So if you want to get in on this, please feel free. 312-981-7200. Text or call. And get ready. If you are somebody who has done a little bit of shady stuff in your life, love to hear from you. I would really like to know about the psychology of this, because I remember definitively deciding in college. I remember having this philosophical time, at probably taking some philosophy while I was in college in my freshman and sophomore year, thinking, lying is hard. It's complicated. It's not satisfying. Doesn't always work. And in the end, I just made the decision to not be that person. You know, maybe I was lying to my parents a lot or whatever it was, you know, some boyfriend. And I just decided, this is not serving me anymore. And I just don't understand why everyone doesn't do that sometime in their teens or 20s. Figure out lying and cheating isn't the way. I'm naive, right?
Well, yeah, we live in an interesting culture where oftentimes lying is rewarded. So it's hard. It's hard to be that person.
Well, we're going to hear more about that and everything else with your help here on WGN. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll do the news headlines. So please do stick around on WGN.
She completely pulled the wool over her town's eyes.
Do you think you were just smarter than everybody else, Rita?
$53+ million is just unbelievable.
She lived quite a life, totally different life than what she portrayed here.
By day, she's wearing municipal clothes, and by night, she's dripping with jewels and furs.
World champion Rita Crundwell.
She had this grand, high-stakes horse empire.
My first thought was, Dixon has that much money? That you could embezzle that much money from a little tiny place like this?
People just trusted her so well, more than anything.
Rita, how did you go to bed and not think, whose lives I'm infecting here?
One of the things the FBI wanted to find out was, did she do this alone? Was she hiding from somebody else?
For 20 years, I worked side by side with this woman, and I never knew her. I never really knew her.
Wow. A little clip from the movie All the Queen's Horses, put together by our guest today, Dr. Kelly Richmond Pope. She teaches at DuPaul Forensic Accounting, and she was integrally involved in this movie and putting it together. And I had a couple thoughts while I was listening to the, reminding myself when I was listening to the clips. She had, like you mentioned, the coach that she finally got together with to carry all these horses to and from shows. Crundwell had spent about $2 million, and the Dixon deficit was about that, too, right? Wasn't there some sort of correlation between, geez, Louise, we could have really used that to keep on budget, let alone all the services that got cut and didn't happen in Dixon throughout her tenure?
Yeah. Yes, you're right.
She harmed some people.
Yes.
She did some harm. Now, this is interesting. I saw this article. Maybe you sent it to me. The ex-Dixon official who stole $54 million from town still earns royalties on show horses. And this article is dated 2015. How long did it take for them to finally get any income going to her away from her?
That money ended up going back to the town. But
excellent.
That's a great U.S. Marshal question. Yes.
Oh, I happen to have one of those handy.
Yes.
You gave me the name of this gentleman, Jason Wadillo.
Absolutely.
Thank you. He's the acting U.S. Marshal for Northern Illinois who oversaw the asset forfeiture of Rita Crundwell's assets. And he's on the phone with us right now. Jason, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Yes. Good evening.
Wow. I don't even know where to begin. Maybe I should ask Kelly to start with you. But, I mean, that's one question. The fact that she, for a while after she went to prison, she was still earning money on her horses. Is that true?
Well, the horses were still earning money, although it was not going to her. So we had taken steps to freeze those assets to include the royalties that she was receiving from the various horse organizations for which she had registered as the breeder. They were entitled to royalties as long as those horses were shown and were living. And so we notified those organizations early on, and they froze those until we could file the appropriate court documents to have those royalties also forfeited And Kelly is correct in that the city of Dixon is the beneficiary of those and will be as long as those horses continue to show and are living.
So let me ask you one big question. 53, 54 mil taken. How much did they get back?
Yeah, so their net deposit from all of the assets that we seized and forfeited and liquidated was about $10.3 million. So we achieved a greater return. However, we were ordered by the court to satisfy claims that were filed against some of the assets. There were a number of expenses, millions of dollars in expenses. We were spending over $100,000 a month just to manage the horses. We had them all across the country, 22 farms, 13 states, from Arizona to Connecticut, from Florida to North Dakota. The bulk of the horses were in Dixon and Beloit, Dixon, Illinois, Beloit, Wisconsin, about a 45-minute drive from one another. So all of those expenses also came off the top. Again, the net was $10.3 million that we gave back to the city. Now, they also did achieve a settlement in the civil matter, a separate independent matter between the city of Dixon and the bank, the auditors, and that was a separate payment of $40 million, for which they netted around $30 million. $10 million went to the attorneys. So when all was said and done, the net between the civil case and the forfeited assets was about $40 million.
Wow, that is good. And I was interested that you said, of course, when you're taking animals, you can't just take them and say, oh, good, I got them, let's sell them. You have to take care of them for a period of time. So like $200,000 a month to care for 400 horses, that makes sense financially, I suppose. But what a hassle.
Yeah, just to clarify, it was $100,000 a month we were spending. So we officially took them into custody in May of 2012, and we were selling them off in September. So by early October, we had liquidated all of the horses, which was our focus given the cost and that these were live animals that could perish, and we had to care for them. So that was our primary focus. All the other tangible assets, the real property, the vehicles, the jewelry, the furnishings, those types of things were secondary to managing the horses.
So, Jason, this is Kelly. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Sitting in my office in downtown Chicago.
All right. So we've been talking for many years now. And so why do you think that this case, while we're still talking about this case, and how does it compare to the other cases that you investigate, that your team investigates?
Sure. So, you know, asset forfeiture financial investigators routinely work these types of cases that involve fraud. In some cases, there is drug activity. So we pursue the ill-gotten gains, if you will, often that are the proceeds of crime. In some cases, we will pursue assets that are used to facilitate crime. But in this case, it was a proceeds theory. And look, we've worked on cases that are as large as what was in the national news with Bernard Madoff, in New York. Mm-hmm. And then we deal with the routine frauds that go on all across our country. This case in particular was somewhat unusual given the fact that it went on for so long. So the fraud went on for more than 20 years undetected. And so that obviously made it somewhat unique. But then more importantly, what was done with the money, the stolen money, was to build what then was one of the most world-renowned horse operations, right, of American quarter horses that, Rita Crundwell was well-known in the industry. She was, the leading horse breeder or leading horse shower year after year after year. Mm-hmm. And so the money was, what I often say is the money was feeding her ego. Raising and breeding and showing horses is a very, very expensive hobby. And so it's not as though there were large prize winnings when she would win these. It was often a trophy, and it was often a year of feed, or a lot of it was the recognition. And so the notoriety of Rita Crundwell and the horse industry was substantial, and that also made it unique. Of course, it came from a town 90 miles west of Chicago, in what really is the heartland of America. A lot of good farming families and a farming community. And so the fact that she was earning $80,000 a year as the city's comptroller, and then sort of her side business was this horse business, and because it was a very, very expensive hobby, it should have raised a lot of questions on where she was generating the income to be so successful. It was sort of a perfect storm, that hung over the city of Dixon for more than 20 years, and but not for the fact that she was taking so much leave and she was out of town. And that's when her crime was detected, was through the city clerk who, as you all now know, had requested bank statements, and a bank statement came across the fax machine that was unfamiliar to her. She took it to the mayor, and the rest is history.
That's all it took. Jason, I'm going to ask you if you have a few more minutes to hang on. I want to take a quick break. But Jason Wadillo is the acting U.S. Marshal for Northern Illinois, who oversaw the asset forfeiture for Rita Crundwell's assets back in 15, probably, or 14, 13, 12?
From 2012 to 2015-ish,
correct? Right, yeah. Very fascinating. If you can hang on for just another minute, we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and finish this conversation with Jason and more with Kelly Richmond Pope, who is the person who made the documentary about all the Queen's horses here on WGN.
There were 6 legitimate City of Dixon accounts at Fifth Third Bank. She routinely moved funds into the legitimate capital development fund, but Rita then set up an additional 7th account no one knew about. To get the process started, she created phony invoices to justify payments for imaginary capital projects, such as fixing sidewalks and street repairs. These phony invoices triggered Rita's transferring money from the city's legitimate capital development fund into her secret account. Remember, no one knew about this account, and it had a similar name to look like a legitimate city account. From her secret account, she wrote checks for her personal expenses, such as spa visits, jewelry, real estate, a motor coach, and of course, quarter horses. She did this process 179 times.
Holy smokes. That is the voice of Kelly Richmond Pope. She is the documentarian who put together all the Queen's horses. She's with us tonight on WGN. I'm Catherine Lake. And on the phone with us, get this. We are the coolest. We've got the acting U.S. Marshal for Northern Illinois who oversaw the asset forfeiture of Rita Crundwell's assets. His name is Jason Wadillo. Thank you for staying with us, Jason.
Yeah, sure.
I think Kelly had a quick question for you. The good question that you had when we were talking about it.
So, Jason, one of the things I've been trying to do for years is get on Rita's visitation list. I haven't been able to do that yet.
I'm not sure. I wonder why.
I don't know if she cares to see me or not, but you get to see her. And as you know, when we do our presentations together, oftentimes people ask you, does she seem remorseful? Can you talk a little bit about how it is when you visit with her, when you've talked to her throughout this whole case? What was it like? Can you give us any insight?
Sure. So shortly after Rita was arrested in April of 2012, the court did release her on bond during the pendency of her case. She was sentenced on Valentine's Day of 2013 and was immediately taken into custody as the judge ordered to begin her lengthy prison sentence. So during the pendency of the case, the adjudication phase, I did meet with her on a regular basis to help educate myself and our team on how best to manage all of the horses. So many of them, as you can imagine, had special diets. They were on certain medications. And so it was pretty important that we understand how best to care for them, and who better to ask than the person who had the most knowledge. So we did have regular interaction during the pendency of the case, particularly during the management of the horses and her other assets. After she was sentenced, we continued to pursue her assets. Many more of her assets were seized. In fact, there was $1 million more in assets that were identified, seized, forfeited, and liquidated after she was sentenced. In partial satisfaction of the forfeiture money judgment that the court ordered. And so from time to time, I would receive tips, emails from the general public asking me if I knew this, if I knew that.
Wow.
Some had theories that there were hidden bank accounts, that there were offshore bank accounts, that there were other assets out there. In fact, we spoke earlier about the royalties, and I frankly learned about the royalties through a tip from the general public, for which I was not initially aware of.
The royalties from showing the horses, and the horses continued to be showed, and they were still somehow under her purview, and the money was still going to her for a brief period.
Well, the money was being held. The horse associations did not pay those payments out after they learned about her crimes. So they were sort of waiting for us to call and
can we please have that money?
Yeah. So then, you know, when she went off to prison, I did meet with her, you know, to conduct further interviews to determine the validity of some of the tips that we had received. I think I've exhausted and heard all of those that may come in or what the possibilities may be. And so there was still interaction with her after she went off to prison. She moved about the country at different federal prisons. And so that there was that interaction. Now, the most commonly asked question that I am asked about this case is, do you believe that she was remorseful for her crimes? Now, this has always been business for me. It's never been personal. I never allow these cases to become personal. Do I have an opinion on whether or not she was remorseful? My personal opinion was that she was not. She was disheartened, perhaps, that she got caught.
Aren't we all?
But I don't believe that there was a lot of remorse in what she even conveyed as an apology to the citizens of the city of Dixon.
And you can't even probably guess why she wasn't remorseful, if she felt entitled, if she felt like, well, I'm doing a service, I'm showing all these horses, and it's bringing a lot of attention to Dixon, isn't that good? We don't know about whether or not any of those were her motives.
Yeah, no, I mean, this was all selfishness, mm-hmm. right? So she began stealing 20-plus years ago in small increments, and it began to snowball. And my experience is with those that commit these types of frauds is they have no exit plan. So they're feeding their egos, they're living a lavish lifestyle, which they enjoy, and it's greed. And so there's no exit strategy, meaning that if they stop stealing, then there's a good chance they're going to get caught, because there will be this influx of revenue to, in this case, the city of Dixon, where questions may be asked, well, where did this money come from? But more importantly, her herd was so large that it took that kind of money to maintain that size herd. And so had she one day cold turkey just stopped stealing the money, why, now how does she maintain this large, very expensive herd of horses?
I can't imagine it. And so comparing, I don't know if we got the final answer from you about, is this wildly different than any other because of the horses? That's the big difference. Or are there other things that made Rita herself different for you than like a Bernie Madoff?
Well, so every case is unique, right? The amount of money that was stolen in the Madoff matter, in the billions of dollars. This, of course, $53.7 million, certainly not chump change, particularly over the period of time that it occurred. And so the uniqueness of this case was the duration of the crime. It was the fact that she put the money into building this world-renowned business that she was running to breed and show horses. You know, over 400 horses, very few people, if any, have that number of horses at one time. And so it made for a very good documentary that Kelly, you know, spent 5 years developing, that has really helped other communities around the country open their eyes, for lack of a better term, to the fact that, you know, this could happen in my community, given the fact that it happened in small town Dixon, Illinois.
Yeah, Jason, I just finished doing a presentation at the Government Finance Officers Association annual conference, and we were shocked at how many people were in our audience, right, Jason?
hundreds or thousands, I suppose. Yeah, it was probably our largest audience. They had different sessions that you could attend during that particular block of instruction, and we certainly stole the show, for lack of a better term.
Our Rita stole the show.
Jason, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us tonight. Jason Wadillo was the acting U.S. Marshal for Northern Illinois and oversaw Rita Crundwell's asset forfeiture and collection, too, and delivery as well of the money. Did you get a chance to bring a check in and say, hey, this is from me?
We did. Well, it's from the federal government, but yeah. we did deliver that check, yes.
Oh, that's great. Well, congratulations for your hard work. I'm glad you got a chance to do it and also for talking with us. Thank you, Jason.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason.
WGN, we're going to come back with more. Kelly Richmond Pope is here. We're talking true crime on WGN.
So it would be her ex-boyfriend. That relationship, I understand, ended last fall. And so did he get anything out of this? He certainly enjoyed the lavish lifestyle that she was living and benefited in that regard. But there was no evidence that he had knowledge or intent. You know, we had no evidence that he transported her to City Hall in the evening hours, for example, to affect this crime. We had no evidence that he helped generate the invoices. Did he benefit? I think arguably he did. Did he have knowledge or intent? It couldn't be proven. Otherwise, he would be charged as well.
Interesting. That is the voice of Jason Wadillo answering questions of residents of Dixon. Is that right?
Yeah, we did multiple screenings in Dixon. So the first time we went back to Dixon, actually, the first screening was at Rita's old house.
Oh, come on. At her house?
Yeah, when we were filming.
This is All the Queen's Horses, by the way. I'm Catherine Lake, Kelly Richmond Pope, the director of All the Queen's Horses, about the woman in Dixon. We all know Rita Crundwell and her 53 mil. Go on.
So when we were filming, we were in it was the summer of 2017, early summer, and the family that bought the house in the auction saw us outside because we were getting footage of Rita's old house, and they invited us over and said, do you want to just come and get some footage? And we were like, sure.
Yes.
And so really super nice family, and they said, well, when you finish the film, we'd love to host a screening. Mm. And I was like, wow, that'd be cool to show this film at the perpetrator's house. Like, who gets to do that? So the first screening we ever did was at Rita's old house. And so the family invited about 60 people. Kathy Swanson was in the audience and her family came. And
Kathy Swanson, the whistleblower.
The whistleblower came. And then a few of Rita's family members came. And when it got out into the town that the film was only shown to a small group of people, people were like, well, no, that's not fair.
We want to see
it. We want to see it. So we contacted the historic Dixon Theater and found some sponsors to pay for renting the theater, because clearly we couldn't say people come buy a ticket to watch the movie.
No.
So we did one screening in November of 2017 and then another screening of March 2018. We've shown it to about 4,000 people in Dixon, I would say. And Dixon has, 16,000 people? So
yeah. Is it that small?
It's small. 000. Small. So so the second time we went, March 2018, Jason came. And so he spent the day having these town hall sessions with residents. And so they had lots of questions.
U.S. Marshal who's helping get the assets back. And they want to find out from him a few more details.
Right. So they had a lot of questions. Yeah. One of the first questions was there any evidence that there were any co-conspirators? Did she do it by herself? And so there was no evidence that showed that there was anyone else that helped her. So
we opened this program, you saying it's a complicated thing, but in some ways it was pretty darn simple.
It's pretty easy. You know, a lot of the crimes are, you know, it's a pretty easy scheme. And so there was no evidence that showed that there was anybody else that helped her.
She didn't need anybody. She was doing it all by herself. Well, because she was doing the job by herself.
Yeah, when you don't have any segregation of duties and there are no internal controls, it's easy to steal.
It's easy to do that.
So that was one of the questions, what happened to Rita's boyfriend, because he was, of course, he had to know what was going on.
Of course.
I mean, but he wasn't charged. And so that was one of the questions that people.
And Kathy showed up. Kathy's still in her job, as far as I know, right, in Dixon?
Kathy Swanson? No,
yep,
she retired.
She retired. Okay. She expressed a little bit of survivor's guilt Did you, in the movie, I believe it was her that was, or there were others that were having some survivor's guilt from this?
Well, I think the emotion that you hear her describe is just our natural emotion of when you know another person is hurting. Mm-hmm. So, yes, Rita did something wrong, but she's still, you know, you worked for her. It's still your boss. It's still a quasi-work friend.
Right.
And you still have a piece of compassion that you wonder, is she okay? And
right.
So I think that was just the human instinct in Kathy.
I believe that. Yeah. And I don't know if I'd have any guilt, but I suppose being the whistleblower, the one who said, dude, I'm not going to come to you. I'm going to go someplace else and find out what went wrong here. And the rest happened. Yeah. We are talking again with Kelly Richmond Pope, who is the director of All the Queen's Horses. But in addition to that, she is a doctor of accounting, and especially forensic accounting, which is not always about crime per se.
Well, so my PhD is in accounting, and forensic accounting is using accounting to really detect and understand the financial statements. So is it always about crime? Let's hope not. But mm-hmm. a lot of times you're using these methods to sort of root out a problem. And so oftentimes those problems can lead, they were done illegally. So
this woman, Rita Crumwell, and her horses, that was her motivator, just plain greed, as Jason indicated. But you got into also with that course, right? The motivation for people to do this kind of stuff and whether or not they should or are liars, or should they steal, or should they embezzle? I was preparing for this program, I was amused at all the different terms we use. Embezzling, well, that's stealing. Why do we have to have a fancy white collar word for that? Why do we have to have white collar as a phrase?
Well, the first thing you said is how we steal impacts the word. So embezzling means something different than a Ponzi scheme.
Oh.
That means something different than financial statement fraud. So we're really describing the action.
Financial statement fraud.
Yeah. So like when you overstate revenue, understate expenses, that's on the financial statement. So okay. The word really lets us know the action. So we don't want to, if we just say steal, we don't know how it was done.
Did they go in the house? Did they take a, yeah.
So embezzlement sort of tells us the type of scheme. And so that's why we need the fancy words.
Very good. And you actually have a person that you have asked to be standing by, pardon me, named Jason Chez. And he's
felon. Jason has a past that mm-hmm. he's willing to share.
Mm-hmm.
Jason comes to my class. He's one of the more popular speakers. But
he actually presents at your class.
Yeah, he presents and speaks. But I really commend him for sharing a story because he took lemons and made lemon meringue pie. So I commend him for the courage, because have you ever had to stand up and tell a group of people the most embarrassing thing that you might have ever done that you can Google and search and always, it's always there? Most of us want to hide that, but he's willing to face it and share it and let other students learn from his mistakes.
And
so,
nothing dies anymore.
Nothing dies.
I mean, there was a time paper gets lining the bird cage and you don't have to worry about it as much after a few years. But all these stories, including Jason's, they're living forever.
Yeah. They're always there. So I really think that it takes some courage to face it and talk about it and open yourself up for questions.
Well, we're going to do that in just a bit. Let's take a quick break. Ash, would you like me to read this one right now? We might as well do this, and then we'll take a quick break, and we'll get Jason on the phone. Jason Chez is, again, a convicted white-collar felon, which I want to dive into, too. Why is it white-collar? Because his collar became blue when he went to prison, I'm pretty sure. That's a good one. 1118 on WGN. I'm Catherine Lake, in with Kelly Richmond Pope. She is a doctor of accounting, a teacher at DePaul, a professor, and did a documentary on All the Queen's Horses. That's the title of the documentary, about the woman from Dixon. You remember Rita Crumwell and her 400 horses. And she's in tonight. We get 3 hours, total of 3 hours, to talk about crime, true crime, the real thing. This is no Law and Order, although they're ripped from the headlines. Maybe they
yeah,
are.
They, yeah. Yeah.
So I actually have an experience, and I'm going to get Jason on the phone here in a second. Jason Chez is actually a convicted white collar felon who has been into your classroom. We're going to talk with him in a second. Maybe his experience is similar to mine. I don't know. I have two jobs that I left and then was contacted after I left that the person under me was stealing. And actually, one of them replaced me and was stealing. One was the youth orchestra up in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestras. They had a really tough time finding an assistant for me when I was first there as the executive director. And the first gal we hired, I actually probably chose her myself. She was too young and didn't really understand anything, and so we let her go. And then the president of the board, thank goodness, he came in and said, let's find you somebody better. And he was the one who helped choose the woman under me. Now, I got let go 4 months later. Different story. But they called me within a month and said, we got to talk to you. We've got a problem. There's some money missing, and it's got your name all over it. She had written checks to herself to reimburse herself, and it said, as per Catherine, needed this. So she was doing kind of like what Rita Crudwell was doing, in a way, making expenses and figuring things out that way. But she eventually got caught. And the second one was when I was working with the Segway store downtown. And the person who replaced me, I left the position to have a baby. And I think it was simply they called and said, again, she's taking money somehow. She was actually taking cash. She was, instead of making transactions go through the system, she'd just take cash and said, oh, our credit card's done. Yeah,
skimming.
That's skimming. Okay. So they're creepy. And they're awful when you find out about these kinds of things. And you do have a little bit of, I have survivor guilt. Why was I not paying enough attention? The second person, of course, was after I left. But the first person, I wasn't paying enough damn attention to the books. It can happen to anybody, right?
Sure.
Okay, thanks. So Jason is on the line with us. Jason Chez is a white collar felon. And he has been gracious enough to work with Kelly in her classroom occasionally, and is now willing to come and tell us his story on the air. Jason, thanks for your time.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm going to let Kelly start. She's the one who's talked to you 1,000 times. She's had you in your classroom. Why don't we start with how this all started with you?
Hi, Jason.
Hi.
How are you? Do you recognize my voice?
I do.
So, you know, you're one of the popular speakers from class. Just quickly, why do you think that students are so interested in your story? Share a little bit about your story.
Mm. Well, I don't think that my story is that exciting. I think it's just that I'm one of the only ones that admits guilt, and I think that they find that interesting, where I'm open about it. Like I told you, I'm the only one I met while incarcerated that was actually guilty. Everyone else, you know, even while they were there, had some kind of excuse. The only one that said, yeah, I did it.
Yeah.
You wanted me to share a little bit of my story?
Sure, thanks.
Okay, so mine was pretty simple. I was I owned a medical equipment company. We specialized in radiology equipment nationwide, and we were real successful and making lots of money, and the opportunity came up to make more money. We were approached by someone from University of Chicago Hospital, and he was the assistant director of radiology and the head of, I think it was IT. I don't remember exactly his title, but he said to us that he worked, his degree was in computer science, and that he had a bunch of work for the hospital that needed to be done, but that he couldn't do it himself. The hospital wouldn't pay him. So he wanted to sub it out to us and then split the profits. So we talked to our attorney, a corporate attorney, and he said, it's not criminal, but the hospital will sue you if they find out. And we were greedy and decided to do it, my partner and I. And it went on for a while, and we got more and more greedy, and we got more risky with the things we were doing with them. Like we were inflating prices, and, you know, he would tell us what was available in the budget, and we'd inflate the prices and then split it with them. And it was just stupid. And then we got caught, and my partner then became a whistleblower, and The rest is history.
The rest is history.
You got whistleblown on. He didn't go to prison?
No, no. That was just crazy. So I fired him, actually, because he did nothing all day but play basketball and mess around. And once I did that, then he went and blew the whistle to protect himself. And he was 100% part of it. I mean, he went to the lawyer's office with me to set everything up. He was driving a new Range Rover because of it. But yeah, he got out of it completely.
Hey, Jason, at any point when you were inflating prices, and were you scared?
Scared? No. Yeah, maybe. I was nervous. My like I had mentioned in the class, you know, you feel it in your gut when you're doing something wrong, and I felt it. I kept justifying it by going back to what the attorney said, that it's not criminal, you know, and I kept justifying what I was doing.
That's what I was wondering. So it was not officially easily described as a crime, but it certainly was. It's skimming, right?
It was more like a skimming thing? Well, it was paying kickbacks.
Kickbacks. You got to have all the words for it. You're right. It helps figure out what it was that they were doing. So kickbacks, right.
Yeah.
That gets you 3 years?
Yeah, well, in the federal system, it's based on the dollar amount more than anything.
Okay.
So they even though there's not federal guidelines anymore, per se, they take the old guidelines and they still use them as a reference.
Interesting.
And, you know, and then they're able to deviate if they want. But my judge just gave it to me, you know, right down the middle. And it basically... What they do is they take the amount of the fraud, basically, and in my case, they claimed that all of the money from the University of Chicago Hospital that we ever sold to them, which was like, you know, $2.5 million or something, that was all fraud. It wasn't, but it would have cost, you know, I had already spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on attorneys, and it would have cost another couple hundred thousand to get someone like Kelly, a forensic accountant, to... dig into it, and really all it would have done is shaved off
6 months, right?
According to my attorney, it would have just shaved off a few hundred thousand, and it wouldn't have made a huge difference in the sentence.
Right. Well, here's this woman, Rita Crundwell, getting 19 years for 20 years of criminality, but she got $53 million. I don't suppose you got quite that much, Jason.
No. I got... No.
What did you learn? What did you learn?
And I didn't buy any horses either.
Uh-huh. Were you really young, too, by the way? You were in your 20s probably when this happened?
Yeah, it was probably 28. And then it all happened pretty fast as far as from the time that it started. I met the director of radiology, or the assistant director, I should say, around the time I was 27, 28. And by the time I was 31, I was... indicted, and I was sitting in jail by the time I was 32.
Good Lord. And what do you do now, Jason?
Yeah. Now I have a small trucking company.
Very good. You own your own company?
Yeah.
That's good.
I haul freight, I own my own trucking company, but haul freight for just one particular company.
So, Jason, when we were talking about you coming on and sharing your story, there was a question that I said to you. I posed this question to you, and I said, Jason, why do people steal? And you said, well, I didn't steal.
Mm-hmm.
Remember you
Wrong
said
word.
That? Remember you said that?
Right.
And you've said, well, I don't think what I did is stealing. Can you talk a little bit about that response? Like, why would you... Why aren't kickbacks stealing?
Or how did you come
to that?
Well,
you know what?
Yeah.
I thought about it more since we talked about it. I guess it is. My initial response, first of all, no one wants to think of themselves as a thief. And when you think of stealing, you know, you think that of like what Rita, whatever her name is, did, that you did the movie on.
Mm-hmm.
And
nobody wants
or the
to
story
her
about
name.
The Segways. Yeah. I don't know. What is it, Croswell or something? I don't know.
Yeah.
But
Crundwell.
Yeah,
we don't like her. We're done with her.
So I think of things like that, or my sister who stole all my money while I was away.
Oh, boy.
That's a different story.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, I guess it is stealing, because the hospital didn't know that whether they were getting the product or not, you know, whatever. The hospital didn't know that they were overpaying for things when we started inflating it. If it was only the initial thing that we set out to do with him, which was where he would do the computer programming, and we didn't inflate things or anything like that, I'd probably fight you on the stealing word. But in this case, because we were charging them more than the going rate, you know, as this progressed, I wouldn't fight you on that.
Wait a minute, you agree with me?
Uh-oh, look out. What? Now you're not going to want to go back to a classroom.
Only on this one point.
I hope there are people listening.
Hope so, too. Jason, you got a minute. Maybe somebody will want to ask you a question. We've got another question or two for you after the bottom of the hour here, but I've got to hit some news. Can you hang on with us?
Sure.
All right, thanks a lot. This is WGN, and we are going to take a quick break here and then get some headlines. So hang with us. It's True Crime on WGN. Little past 11:30. Thanks for staying up for us here on WGN. I'm Catherine Lake, and I have Kelly Richmond Pope here. She is a doctorate of accounting and is particularly interested in forensic accounting, and it's not always about crimes. It's about figuring things out, but tonight we're talking about true crime. I will admit, I want to know if Roger Badish has a story, and Ashley, I want to know if you have a story of your youth, of when you took something. Oh, come on. You know, that voice. Yes, you did. What did you do? Come on, give it to us. Did you get caught? Did you steal something from a store when you were three? What do you got?
Not a lot, but a few moving violations. One where, I know, moving violation is nothing. But this one, apparently crossing a double yellow line because I missed my exit.
Ooh.
Who hasn't done that?
Who
please
hasn't?
Come on.
Have you ever apparently used the photocopier at work?
No photocopier at work. Maybe a few candy bars when I was really, really young from the candy counter.
Office supplies.
I got slapped on the wrist. Mm-hmm. And
took some office supplies home.
No.
Oh, I absolutely did that. I absolutely did that.
No, now I have, when I was younger, I didn't do it, but now I have grandkids, so when we have to buy school supplies, who doesn't have office supplies now?
I mean, you know. Exactly. They're all over
want
the place.
Want some paper, kids? I've got lots.
How about you, Ash? Have you done anything like that? Anything at all from your... You're still a child, first of all.
Yeah.
What, are you 20?
I'm 22. When I was in probably middle school, I got a dry erase board, but I didn't have any markers.
Uh-oh.
So then when there was like a garage sale that my family friend was doing, and they had a bucket of dry erase markers that they were selling for probably
a penny.
Yeah,
or
like,
who knows?
Not like,
yeah,
a quarter maybe. Yeah. But I remember I took a red one, snuck it home, and I never used it because I felt the guilt, and I didn't tell my mom about it until I was like maybe a junior in high school. I was like, by the way, I stole from
our friends
from our friend's garage sale. But that was probably that. Like I was never taught like don't steal. It was just kind
of
something that you knew not to do in my family. You know,
of course.
Something weird.
Most
so,
do probably.
Right.
Like, I think it's implied.
Yeah, it was like I see my parents buying things, so obviously in my mind it's like, oh, you don't just take something without buying it.
Right.
And I knew I was doing something bad when
you
I took
did.
It.
That's you knew.
Yeah. So when I was taking it, I knew it, but I was like, I have a dry erase board, but no dry erase marker. This is the only option.
But you're desperate.
I don't have a quarter right now.
I'm so desperate.
Yeah, so I like snuck it home, and I never used the dry erase marker. But I think I ended up throwing it out.
Yeah.
You should have called me. I had lots of them.
But I think it's the area of the gray areas, because I think we're talking about really distinct things. But
right?
It's the things like downloading music or using someone's, you're putting some software, a program on your computer and you didn't buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're using a friend's discount and you don't work at the store that they're working at.
Man,
those are
everybody's
the kinds of
feeling
things.
Bad now. You're including,
I mean,
everybody.
We're not talking about the blatant things. I'm talking about the gray things, the things that no one would ever know if you didn't tell them. Those are the things. And we don't have to go back to our childhood.
It's
we could
true.
Probably start last week.
Now,
can
now
I ask
that
a question?
Of course.
That has been bugging the heck out of me for months. So, on Facebook, you can do videos, and you can put music behind the videos.
Oh, this is a good one.
Hold on. Hold on now. So, I've got music that I've legally downloaded onto my phone, and I edit it because, you know, videos can't be that long or you'll never put it on Facebook. And I put the music behind the video. All of a sudden, you post it on Facebook. Facebook says, oh, no, 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 you don't have the rights to this music.
Happens
you can't
to me
do
a lot.
It. All right, so now I go to YouTube. And let's say the Beatles' Rain is posted 25 times by 25 different people, none of them having the rights to it, except for the one at the very top that says by Vivo or by Warner Brothers or whoever the music company is.
Right.
How do those videos stay up and I can listen to them, but on Facebook, my edited version, not even 90 seconds worth, can't be on?
I think YouTube has the same rules as Facebook. What's the issue there? What do you think?
That I don't know.
Yeah, why would you? I bet our next guest will know that when we start talking with Brett, maybe later on in the 12 o'clock
maybe
hour.
Maybe that's a legal question, yeah. I think.
Well, right now we have Jason on the phone, who was actually a convicted white-collar felon, and he shared his story on how he embezzled money, served 3 years for embezzling from the University of Chicago Hospital. And I wonder if he would say, that's what I did. Did I embezzle? It's a little... He skimmed or he overcharged.
He received kickbacks.
Kickbacks. We decided it was going to be kickbacks. But Jason's still on the line with us. Thanks for hanging on, Jason. I appreciate it. I was curious about something you said about your sister, and I want you to get into that. I'll tell you my quick little story is that my father kept his wallet and his change on the top of the dresser, and when he wasn't around, I'd go pick up quarters, dimes, nickels, and then eventually a dollar, two, three. I didn't know what to do with it. I was too young to spend it, so I just stuffed it behind my radio, and my mom found it. You know, her way of finding things was to just lay it out on my bed. I come home from school. Oh, there's all my money. What's going on? Mom's been cleaning. And what do? She says, where did all this come from? Am I going to say, Dad? I told my sister this probably 10 years ago. I said I stole it from my sister. So she marched me into my sister's room and she called me a brat and it was over. But if it had been Dad, it would have been a whole different thing. But darn right I knew I was doing something wrong. I was hiding that stuff. Jason, you got a story about your sister, huh?
Oh, yeah, I have a good one.
Not the same, but...
there's a little bit more money involved. So when I went away... I still had money in the trust. I basically spent all my money on attorneys and accountants and everything. And then what I didn't spend was money that was in my trust. And I made my sister trustee before I left. And because my attorney said not to trust your wife because they usually leave you when you go away.
Oh, man.
They're like, so put your sister in charge. So I did. And a few weeks before getting released, she, acting as trustee, signed all, you know, she basically took all my money.
Oh.
And made it disappear.
Oh.
As well as doing a few other things. So I had to sue her civilly and I never got nearly all of it back. I got just a tiny amount. But,
so this is the kind of the reaction of people. I mean, she got mad at you. She got mad at you for what you did.
And mad at me for what?
For the crime?
No, it had nothing to do with that. It was just an opportunity for her to grab it.
Her own crime. Yeah.
This had nothing to do with... I didn't do anything bad to her.
No, of course not. But I wondered if she was still thinking...
This was just me not being around and her just wanting her husband to not be a bum. So she basically used it to buy him a business and, join a country club and be fancy. Yeah.
Well, that's you're going to say something?
So... Jason, I was going to ask you, given that you were this successful business owner, this entrepreneur that then lost your business and saw yourself facing federal prison time, what was that transition like? I mean, you went from, I'm sure, a large house, fancy cars, great vacations and great food to adjusting to what we probably see on Orange is the New Black.
Or, uh-huh.
You know, what was that like?
Well, I've never seen Orange is the New Black, but
yes,
I know
have.
The reference. I know what you're saying.
Yes, you have.
No, I haven't. I haven't.
Okay.
But I have a lot of friends that tell me to watch it.
Okay.
That was the worst part. That was the worst part. The worst part is
walking in that door.
Oh, yeah. Oh, but once you go walk in the door, the first night that you sleep there, all the stress is gone.
Oh.
Because... it's finally over. You're done. That whole legal process of uncertainty. Not, you know, I never got in trouble before, so I didn't know what happens. I don't know what happens after you're arraigned and what the steps are. And even though I had the best attorney that money could buy, you know, Bill Ziegelmuller, I felt comfortable because I knew that I was in good hands and that I wasn't getting, you know, bad legal advice, but it was just the unknown. And so, you know, when I finally turned myself in, yeah, I mean, that's just awful driving there. You know, luckily I got to self-surrender.
Oh, my gosh.
But so and actually my attorney drove me there. And when we walked in, it was on Veterans Day, so they were short-staffed. Mm. And we went into the counselor's office right in the front door, and he goes, which one is Jason? And so I pointed to the attorney, and I've never seen this guy's face just turn, you know, totally what? Like hell. Yeah, like he was
Jason,
so uncomfortable.
My car. I can't defend against this. That is very funny. Jason, I am so proud of you for coming on the radio and being part of Mary Pope's class. I just, I'm grateful that you are as centered a human as you are, that you can talk about this with humor, too.
Oh, well, thanks.
I appreciate your time.
Sure, anytime.
All right, we're going to get into the news shortly, but we're going to take a quick break first. This is WGN. It's about 11:53, just before midnight. I'm Catherine Lake. I'm WGN. I have Kelly Richmond Pope here. She is a doctor of money. I've suddenly lost the word.
I'm
an accounting
professor at DePaul University.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. And she did that amazing documentary about all the Queen's horses, the woman in Dixon, Rita Crudwell, who took all the money from Dixon that she could possibly steal and bought 400 horses with it. That was our first hour. And then we spoke with Jason just recently, who was really fascinating. I can't believe you found somebody who would be so honest and self-effacing about what he had done and how it had affected his life. And he comes into your classroom regularly, Jason does.
He does. But when you think about it, when you can Google your name and read your whole case online, own it.
Own it. You might as well talk about it.
Might as well talk about it. Might as well own it.
Right, right, right.
And correct some of the things that might be wrong. Because you remember a lot of times you're reading a story that a journalist interviewed you about, mm-hmm. and so maybe the facts of the crime could be brief.
Right.
And there's more details to get into.
Right.
And so it's their opportunity to really right their wrong.
How'd you find him?
I met him through another colleague of mine who is currently serving 6.5 years in federal prison for mortgage fraud. Yeah.
Oh, for mortgage fraud.
Mortgage fraud, yeah.
So how does that get accomplished?
What did he do?
How does mortgage fraud happen?
Well, if you recruit straw buyers and
straw buyers?
Yeah. So say, for instance, I give you money to put in your account. I give you $20,000 to put in your account or $60,000 to put in your bank account to make it look like you have this money.
Okay.
And you have good credit.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of borrowing your identity to get a loan.
Oh, wow.
And so you're and I'm paying you for your identity.
Right.
Straw buyer.
Wow, I've never even heard that term.
And so he was involved in a mortgage fraud situation and was found guilty. Mm. Anyhow, I met Jason through him.
Okay, so did he meet him in prison?
No, okay. He hadn't gone yet.
So, wow.
He's so, there now.
And then we're getting into this area of white-collar crime. Does Rita Crudwell, she's white-collar, right? That's white-collar.
Yeah, so white-collar is more about the profession. You know, okay. Like, you know, you're...
That's what I always thought it was,
yeah.
But it's become so broad.
Yeah, so it's more about the profession. It's actually a term that was developed by a man named Edwin Sutherland. And he decided to talk about the misconduct of high-ranking executives. And so the term white-collar crime, he wrote a book called White-Collar Crime. Mm. And that was the first time that anyone actually talked about the misconduct of business executives.
I guess you have to distinguish. Like you said, you got to have a word for every kind of moving of money that's not legal. Is it skimming? Is it embezzlement? I guess you have to have the words for it. But it irritates me because it's in some ways it's just saying, well, it's not as bad because it's white collar crime.
Well, it's you know, I think you distinguish between violent crimes. So you think about people stealing without a weapon. Mm. You know, you're using papers and documents and contracts to steal money. And oftentimes you can steal far more money doing that than a street crime. So I think we're just distinguishing the violence versus nonviolent, who's doing it. You know, you think about socioeconomic status when you think about white collar crime. There's certain people that are in that category that are not in other categories. So
now how do they wind up getting into better prison environments than others? How does, because you're not supposed to use your money to make that happen.
So like one thing Jason said, it depends on your legal representation. So he had a great attorney, a great firm. But I also think we're talking about the difference between committing federal crimes versus state crimes.
Oh, okay.
And so when you think about federal crimes, facilities may be nicer. Prison sentences can be longer because you serve 85% of that time. State crime, your sentence could be longer, but it also could be reduced, and the facility could be not as nice as a federal facility.
Did each of these guys get caught into federal?
They were in federal.
They both, even Rita and Jason so far?
Yeah, so Rita's in a federal prison. Rita's actually in Pekin, Illinois.
Is she really?
She's in state.
Oh, nice.
So maybe she's listening. Who knows?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Maybe she'll call. Who knows?
Rita, 312-981-7200. Love to hear from you or anybody
else.
Just
some girl chat, right?
Just some girl chat. We just want to see how it happened.
Ash wants to talk to her.
Exactly. Ashley has a few words she might give her. Are you an Illinois native?
Yes, I am.
Did you know about this woman at all, or are you too young to have really been paying attention?
I feel
much?
Like when I was listening to some of the clips you guys sent me over, I feel like I did know about it, but I didn't know much of the facts.
You were probably in high school when it was going on.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I heard about it because I have friends and family from Dixon, so it was a big story.
You'd be surprised, though, how national and how international the story has become, because when Jason Modillo seized those horses, the
right.
horses were auctioned and sent as far away as New Zealand, Australia. And so demand for the film has gone to those places because that's where the horses went. So
the horses were all here. I thought he said that they were spread out and he had to gather them to be able to disperse them again.
They were in among 13 states.
They were.
So all here being they're all in the U.S. But when they were auctioned, they were sent some internationally.
Wow.
So that's what made this such a global story.
Yeah.
And why it was ended up on Netflix. We were on Netflix for a year. We just ended 2 days ago on the 10th. Now we're on iTunes, Amazon Google
Prime,
Play, all these other
that's
places.
That's right, all the Queen's horses.
But it's just...
It's stunning.
It is.
It is stunning.
Jaw-dropping.
It is jaw-dropping. And like I said, I went through a pretty good reckoning when I was a kid in college. I was 19. I remember thinking, lying, not for me. It's too hard on my soul.
But you know, I have a really great friend. Her name is Abby Ellen. She has a book out called Duped. And one of the things that she talks about in her book is about lying. And a statistic that she quotes in her book is... most people lie 10 times a day.
Come on.
10 times a day.
And
so Abby and I have been talking about creating, and we are creating, something called the lie log. Where you log your lies and own it 10 times a day.
Interesting. Because it can be anything.
It could be anything. Yeah. Like, your hair looks great. Your hair does look great. But, you know, I might say your hair looks great. And I might not think that, but I do think it looks great. But just using that as an example.
That's a really bad example.
I'm sorry.
God. All right. You heard the tone. We got to get moving on here. But we're going to come back and talk more with Kelly Richmond Pope about true crime. The Chicago stories are told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, you can just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. This news is sponsored by PermaSeal Basement Systems, and we're going to check in with Roger Battish right now. Welcome to True Crime on WGN Radio. It's Catherine Lake with Kelly Richmond Pope, and we are talking about true crimes all over the state, all over the whole country, for that matter. And right now we've got Brett Johnson on the line. This is going to be really interesting. I can't wait to talk with Brett. Thank you, Brett, for being here. I appreciate your time. White-collar cyber crime. A whole different...
White-collar cyber crime.
That's what we're going to identify you with. So, Brett, tell us about you. Give us a little 401 on you, 411 on you. How did you get to be on in Kelly's world?
And hey, Brett, I want
to
say
hi. Well, how did
again.
I get to be? Hey, Kelly, how are you?
Good.
Great. Well, the Secret Service called me the original Internet Godfather. And the way I got that title, I had 39 felonies, a place on the United States Most Wanted list, an escape from prison, and I built the first organized cybercrime community. It was called Shadow Crew. Shadow Crew laid the foundation for today's darknet, or it was a precursor to today's darknet and darknet markets, and it laid the foundation for the way modern cybercrime channels still operate today.
Wow.
So
that's a nice resume.
That's my claim of notoriety.
That is notorious. Absolutely. So let's break that down a little bit. The dark web is something that not everybody really understands and what it means to call something the dark web. It's kind of like the black market of the internet. Is that right?
A lot of it. So the dark web, you've got three sections. You've got the surface web, the deep web, and the dark web. The surface web is basically anything that Google can find. Anything that's not indexed is what picks up the deep web. That's emails, things that don't have a URL, anything behind some sort of wall or barrier that someone would need to pass through. Within the deep web, you have the dark web, and the dark web is this area where you have to have specific software to access it, specifically the Tor browser. The Tor browser was created by the United States Navy. It went open source after a while. Now you've got, there are several legal things on the dark web as well, but most of it, it's known basically for the criminal content, whether it be the stuff I was engaged in, which was financial cybercrime. You've got things like pedophiles on there, things like that as well.
So literally,
that is what the dark web is.
It's available. It's there. You just got to know how to get to it. I can't even begin to ask how you find it.
You don't want to know.
I don't want to know,
probably. Find it?
Well, I'll take that back.
I don't want to know.
Now, you probably do want to know, because what you'll find when you start talking to Brett and you spend some time, all of your information is on the dark web. Every last thing. Your social security number, all your addresses, your age, probably for $2.99 for sale.
Seriously.
That's what I've learned.
That's true. We have this perception, and I work for the good guys now. I'm the new catch-me-if-you-can guy.
Okay.
But we have this perception that people tend to think, oh, there's something that I can do to make sure my information is not compromised. The truth of the matter is that, as Kelly said, everyone's information is out there. Last year alone, we had 1,500 reported breaches.
1,500.
And of those 1,500 reported breaches...
Yeah.
1,500. And of those reported breaches, 2.6 billion, with a B, records were compromised. That's just last year. So everyone's information is out there. And it's important that we understand that. And once we understand that, what can we do to make sure that since our information is out there, what can we do to make sure a criminal can't use it?
So nothing.
That's what I'm hearing. She said during the commercial break, I want you to know, Brett, she said he could invade you right now. He could get everything he needed on you right now if he wanted to.
Well, unfortunately, that's true, but I'm no longer doing that. So.
Okay.
But what I tell people to do is as of September 18th of last year, credit freezes became free. So you can now freeze your credit, but don't stop there. Freeze your children's credit as well, because children are the number one victims of identity theft.
My 9-year-old?
25% of all kids.
Come on.
Your 9-year-old. 25%, 1 in 4 of all kids will be a victim of ID theft.
That's what it is. It's
so
ID. It's cybercrime. It's
now.
ID theft. It's them saying, I'm going to become Bailey Clue. Wow.
Absolutely.
That's crazy.
Most crime online or financial-wise has an element of identity theft attached to it. So freeze your credit. Monitor all accounts. And when I say monitor all accounts, I mean everything. It's your credit, your bank, your credit card, your credit report, everything.
Monitor.
Place alerts on the accounts where you can. And I already know that both of you guys use the same password across multiple websites.
Oh, man. How does he know that?
Because he's watching you right
now. Because everyone does it.
Oh. See, I was bought into that. I really thought he'd done a little clicking while we were chatting. Okay, no, you're right. You're right. So the same password just can't. But then how do Dashlane, right? You got to get yourself a password monitor. Do they work? Do they protect you?
Use a password manager, and they do work.
They protect
that takes
you.
All that out of your hands. It will change the passwords for you. It will log in for you, everything else. So use a password manager. I don't care which one you use. Just use one of them.
Any of them.
And that right there, those three things will make you safer than 99% of every single person that's online right now.
Three things. Monitor everything, not just your bank accounts. Make sure
right.
you have
monitor.
A, yep. That's the next one.
Freeze credit.
That's
password
right.
Password manager.
And password manager.
So, Brett, I want to talk a little bit about your story a little bit. And
okay.
Question I asked you today, we spent some time together this afternoon at DePaul, a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
How dangerous are you?
You know, now I'm not. Now,
you still have the knowledge in your head, though, right?
Okay,
how,
say words.
Yeah,
how dangerous are you?
Yeah. So how dangerous are you?
I could be pretty dangerous.
Meaning what? What level are we talking about?
I'm one of the more sophisticated criminals that are out there. So if you look at, I was connected with a lot of Russians, a lot of Ukrainians, a lot of the most deprecated hackers and cyber criminals out there. I led all those guys. And to be the leader of a group like that, you pretty much have to know every single thing that they're able to do and be able to do it yourself.
Did you elect Trump? Are you responsible for Trump?
Pardon?
Did you elect Trump? Is it your fault? I just want to know.
I cannot take credit for that.
Oh, okay. You said Russians. You said cyber. I'm thinking, all right, so that's not it. But what kinds of things? It was all financial? Is it all financial that you're after?
All financial. And to be fair with you, I mean, I had nothing to do with Trump. As a felon, I couldn't even vote.
Oh, so
that
during
not
that
on my
time.
Shoulders.
All right, good enough. What kinds of things were on your shoulders? Can you talk any specifics at all? Any special
sure,
story?
Sure, you want to... special stories. Let's talk about some of the victims that I had. How about that?
Sounds good.
All right. At one point, we were the groups that kind of refined phishing as you know it today. One of the main sites that we fished out was E-Trade, and we had
Brett,
fished probably.
Can you define phishing before you go further? Can you define phishing?
Sure. So phishing is a social engineering technique that uses emails basically to send out a fake email that spoofs another website. So you'll get an email that looks like it comes from your bank account or Hulu or Netflix or your E-Trade account in this case. So we sent out several million different E-Trade fake emails in order to get people's login credentials and their entire identity profile.
Oh boy.
So we got all these E-Trade accounts. We had access to over 200,000 E-Trade accounts. What we initially started doing is we would find someone with a fat account, someone with a nice retirement portfolio, and we would sell everything that they had and wire the money out to bank accounts that we controlled, and we would cash out like that.
Done.
That lasted for about 6 months.
Because?
At which point, at that point, E-Trade shuts down all ACH withdrawals. So even if you had a legitimate account, you couldn't ACH the money out of that point.
Meaning fast.
So
it has to be sort of a week turnaround. You can get that check or whatever. They slowed the process
right.
down. Okay.
They slowed it down. Mm-hmm. So what we did was, is we're still sitting on probably 30 or 40,000 of these E-Trade accounts. The question is how do you make money on that as a criminal? And the answer that we had was this pump and dump scheme. So we would find someone again with a fat portfolio. We would sell all their blue chip stocks. And then instead we would buy some penny stock for that. At the same time, we would set up a fraudulent E-Trade account that we controlled, buy into the same penny stock, and as we bought with the stolen funds, with the stolen accounts, it would boost our money up on our accounts. So what we were doing is we were wrecking people's entire retirements for a couple of thousand dollars at a time.
Wow.
And that's one of the things I'm adamant about talking about, is that cybercrime has no redeeming features. A cyber criminal and criminals in general, there's no good quality to them. I'm a better person now, but at one point I was a very despicable human being. I have no redeeming qualities whatsoever.
All right, hang on to that thought for just 1 second, because I beg to counter that, but Brett Johnson's on the phone with us right now as a convicted white-collar cyber criminal. We're talking with him and with Kelly Richmond Pope, and we're going to come back in just a minute. It's Saturday, Day Baseball from Clark and Addison as the Cubs host the Pirates at Wrigley, Saturday at 1 on WGN-TV. Ashley. She rocks. True crime on WGN Radio. We are talking about it all night here. I'm Catherine Lake with Kelly Richmond Pope, and we are talking true crime, real actual crimes. The first hour we talked about the woman who stole all the money from Dixon, Illinois, and bought a bunch of horses, as you recall. And then that's a jail cell. Is that what that sound was? And then we've been talking with a gentleman who was, let's see, Jason Chez was a convicted white-collar felon because he embezzled money from the University of Chicago.
Hospital.
And now we are speaking with, and I've got to get my notes in front of me. Thank you. Brett. Where is his last name?
Johnson.
Thank you. Brett Johnson, who was a convicted white-collar cyber criminal, which is one of the scariest kind in my world, because that can wipe you out, and you can't do a darn thing about it.
Takes a lot to recover from it.
It sure does. And you've had Brett Johnson. Thank you for coming on the show with us, Brett Johnson, on the phone. And you've had
Absolutely.
Him in your class as well at DePaul.
Yeah, he comes regularly, and I spent half the day talking to him this afternoon.
What kinds of things do you do in your classroom with Brett? What kinds of...
Well, he shares his story, and we'll get into that now, you know, just how this started for him, because he's developed a level of expertise that is pretty unique, and now he shares his expertise with people so they can protect themselves.
Catch Me If You Can was a great reference, Brett. I truly appreciate that, because I love that film, and I love that it ends up with him being a professional check-kiting professional. And you, in the same way, you were on the U.S. Secret Service Most Wanted list, and now you're helping them out.
I'm trying. I'm doing everything that I can to protect people from the type of person I used to be.
So, Brett, one question I often forget to ask you is, at your height, how much money were you making, and how much money could you steal in a day at a desk looking at a computer screen?
So at my height, first of all, I didn't make money. I stole money.
Okay.
But when I was stealing money, the most lucrative crime that I engaged in was tax return identity theft. I was the guy who created that. So that's the reason everyone's tax returns are delayed every single year. I'm the idiot who started that crime. I got to the point where I could file a tax return manually once every 6 minutes. I would file 10 hours a day from Sunday through Wednesday. Thursday, I would take a road trip. I'd plot out a map of ATM machines, and I would cash out on a weekly basis $160,000. So that's what I was stealing weekly. I did that for 10 months out of the year. I would take $150,000, put it in a backpack, throw it in a spare bedroom that I had. One day you wake up, you open up the bedroom, the door to the bedroom there, and you look in, and you're like, I have to do something with all that money. And then I learned how to launder money from that point.
Oh, right. But, laundering has to happen, of course.
Laundering is very stressful.
Oh, yeah.
Very stressful.
It's extremely stressful.
You know those three steps?
I saw Breaking Bad. I know.
Laundering is hard.
You need yourself a car wash, what you need.
Yeah.
Wow.
The placement,
you know,
the integration.
I just got through watching Breaking Bad, and it's uncanny how correct that show is about getting the criminal mindset down.
Really?
It really is outstanding.
It really was. And let's review for those who did or did not even see. Breaking Bad, he got cancer. He was a teacher, right? And he didn't have enough money to even pay for his own treatment, and he certainly didn't have anything to leave for his family. And he met just the wrong person at the wrong time, right? He met that drug-dealing kid and started, and if I recall, it's been a long time since I saw that first episode, but he started talking with him about what is he doing with his time, and gee, you could be making a whole lot more if you made it better.
Well, yeah, because he was a chemistry teacher.
He was a chemistry teacher.
So he was passionate about the science.
Yes, see, once again.
You know, it was his passion. But, you know, Brett, something that you said, and I just want to tell you, this book, you saw me with it today. Breaking Bad, I think, was accurate, except the role probably of the FBI agent. And this book I'm reading right now.
Agreed.
It's so good.
His brother-in-law, or was there another FBI agent?
The brother-in-law. So I'm reading this book here called FBI Myths and Misconceptions, Debunking Clichés for Those Who Read, Watch, and Write Crime Dramas About the FBI or Have Always Wanted to Be a Special Agent.
Great book.
It's by Jerry Williams. And it says a manual for armchair detectives. It is so great because what she does is, first of all, she talks about all the things you think the FBI is or isn't. And then she goes through these TV shows and movies and says this was correct or this wasn't correct about the FBI's role. So I would imagine that the brother-in-law, his role might have been a little exaggerated.
Why did you think so, Brett?
I would agree. Yeah, and again, I have no idea what the mindset is of agents at all. I do know that with Bryan Cranston, the character that he played, you know, he starts out with that wanting to help his family, wanting to leave something for his family. Mm-hmm. But as the series progresses, it gets to the point where he really doesn't worry about that as much
power
as he does the commission of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what every single person I've ever spent time with or committed crime with or anything else, it's the exact same way. The crime becomes more important than anything else. And
crime,
it was that way with me. I mean,
not getting caught?
I didn't love people as much as I loved the crime.
Well, okay, doing it, but not about the idea of getting caught.
But Brett, you know, I push back on that with you because it's not necessarily the crime, it's the challenge. It's the challenge.
Oh, yes.
It's the adrenaline.
Yes.
You know, the endorphins of that challenge. Like, can I actually get away with this? And when you do, there's like a high.
Right.
You know, so
it's not fear. Nothing to do with fear.
Yes.
You're never going to get caught. Why would you get caught?
Well, it's a big ego boost.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's all about the ego. And especially with cybercrime, you have to have a really, really big ego. You have to believe that it's David versus Goliath and that you, the cyber criminal, are David and you're able to defeat billion-dollar corporations.
So it's David versus Goliath, not Robin Hood. You're not doing any good.
Right.
You're not pretending you're doing any good. You are taking down the big boys and thinking you're doing a favor to everybody else by doing that.
It's not even doing a favor. It's I can defeat a billion-dollar company. I can defeat all these security professionals, just me, my laptop, just me.
Mm.
And when you do that, you gain the respect of every single person within that cybercrime community at the same time. So it keeps feeding the ego over and over again.
So for you, it was that transition. It was, I need a few bucks, and now I need the crime. I need to continue doing this because I'm getting a charge.
With me, I was a little bit more complicated than that. With me, my first crime was at 10 years old. I come from a family. My mom was the criminal in the family. So at age 10, I'm shoplifting food to feed me and my sister. And that springs into shoplifting clothes, jewelry, music, toys, everything else. And as I got older, I got more and more involved in the types of crime that side of my family committed until finally I branch off on my own into cybercrime. And I used the tools that I had gained as a kid.
You were cultivated.
To be a crime, right? Exactly. I was kind of trained to be a criminal. I don't say that resulted, that my childhood resulted in my choices as an adult, but I do say that if I had chose to be a criminal, that they gave me all the tools that I needed.
Wow. We got to take another break. Can you hang on for another minute and stick with us?
Sure.
You're being very kind at this very late hour. We will take a quick break, and we will talk more with Brett Johnson, who is a convicted white-collar cyber criminal. You want to ask me any questions about how to avoid getting taken by him, someone like him, you better call in, 312-781-7200, 781-981-7200, and we'll be right back on WGN. It's getting on there. It's WGN. I'm Catherine Lake. Kelly Richmond Pope is with me, and Brett Johnson's on the phone. We're talking about crime, true crime, embezzlement, stealing, whatever word you want to use for it. We're talking about it. Brett is a convicted white-collar cyber criminal, one of the best in the world, in the country. How would you say, Brett?
You know, I don't like to brag, and I don't even want to say, but I was considered one of the best on the planet. Yeah.
Wow! Because the U.S. Secret Service got into it and said you were one of the most wanted. Why did they get
right,
involved?
I led the groups.
Why the Secret Service? Why did they get
involved? Why the Secret Service? The Secret Service, part of their charter is to protect the monetary supply of the United States. So what we were doing, what really got law enforcement attention with us, we had a thing called the CVV1 hack. We were phishing a lot of bank account and credit card information. What we were able to do is we were able to use the information that we were phishing to encode that on a counterfeit credit card or a counterfeit debit card and then take it to an ATM machine and steal money out of the ATM machine. Daily, what we were stealing on a daily basis per user was $30,000 to $40,000.
Wow.
That is what got law enforcement attention. The group that I set up called Shadow Crew. Shadow Crew made the front cover of Forbes, August of 2004. October 26th of 2004, the United States Secret Service arrested 33 people in 6 countries in 6 hours. I was the only guy who got away.
Oh my gosh!
A few months later, they gave me a job.
Yeah, they gave, seriously,
4 months after that, and they ended up hiring me. And I'm the idiot that when they hired me, I continued to break the law from inside of the Secret Service offices.
You're like Mark Whitaker from the ADM price fixing scandal. Mark Whitaker worked as an FBI informant. He embezzled $8 million
while he was informing.
Yeah. But his rationalization was to protect his family. You know, because he felt like once he became a whistleblower and let the authorities know that ADM was involved in this international price fixing scandal, he would not have a job anymore. So while he was an informant, he embezzled $8 million. So you're just like him.
Wow. So how long were you?
I didn't try to really justify it like that, but I just I was sitting there and I noticed they weren't really paying attention. So I just started breaking the law inside of the office.
Unbelievable. Did you ever go to prison?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I went to prison. So they find out that I was screwing them over. They revoked my bond. I was out on bond at that point in time. They revoked my bond. The bond gets reinstated. I take off on a cross-country crime spree trying to steal enough money to move down to Brazil.
Right.
Wake up one morning, I was in Las Vegas the night before. I'd stolen $160,000. Wake up the next morning, sign on to one of these criminal forums. There's my name, United States Most Wanted, beside of it. And I'm like, oh, my. So what do? I do what any normal person would do. I load up and I go to Disney World. I last 6 weeks in Disney World. Secret Service, they arrest me, send me to prison. I'm in prison for 6 weeks until I escape.
Wow.
And then they catch me again 3 or 4 weeks after that.
This is going too fast.
And send me to a real prison at that point.
This is going,
I serve out my time.
So fast. They literally find you at Disney.
They found me in Orlando. I had rented a timeshare for 9 months. I paid cash for that,
of course,
and
cash.
I had my year pass for Disney World and Universal theme parks, and I was going every day. They just happened to find me at the apartment that I was staying at that point in time.
Brett, what about all the people that were around you that knew you were doing this? I mean, I would imagine that if you walked into a place of business and paid cash, 10 grand or something for something, that would alert someone like, maybe I need to call somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Like what about all the people that were around you that witnessed what you were doing and no one ever said anything?
Well, no, because when you've got that kind of money, they like money. So my wife at that point in time, I was married. My first marriage was 9 years and it took 3 years for her to find out that I was a criminal. The next 6 years, she enjoyed spending the money, but she had more of a moral compass than I did. She got guilty over it and ended up leaving me. But my friends,
she didn't turn you in.
I lied to all my friends about what I did.
Mm-hmm. What'd you tell them that you did?
Frequent.
Yeah.
What'd you say? You said you lied.
What did I tell them I did?
Yeah.
I told them I was a fraud consultant. I just didn't tell them on which side of the fraud equation I was consulting.
Okay.
Bizarre.
So when they found out I was a criminal, I lost all my friends at that point.
Wow. So has crime investigation changed dramatically in your tenure now?
It has for cybercrime. When I was committing cybercrime, really law enforcement had no clue about how to track these people, about the dynamics of cybercrime, how the entire operation worked, or anything else like that.
When was this?
Now, I committed crime, cybercrime, up through about 2007.
Okay, that's a long time ago.
Right. Now law enforcement, and I speak at Quantico, I work with international law enforcement, with the FBI, all these other groups as well. Law enforcement now, they're much more competent. They're scary good at what they're doing. The problem now, though, is cybercrime is so big that a government can no longer arrest its way out of the problem. There's too many players out there. There's too many criminals. You can't put them all in jail.
So what's the answer? All the things that we talked about, the freezing the credit, checking your accounts a lot.
That's the answer. I mean, we have to have regulation. And as you pointed out with our president now, we really don't have a cybersecurity policy. So we're going to have to wait a while on that.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to have regulation to protect people. At the same time, people have to take a proactive stance against cybercrime. It's not enough to have a security monitoring company or something like that. You have to be aware of your environment. It's not just your physical environment. You have to be aware of your online environment as well. You have to have that situational awareness and understand that the internet, while it's a great tool, it's also a tool that can be used by criminals to victimize you.
And so, it is being used.
So, Brett, you are a reformed cyber criminal. Why should we listen to you and believe you? Why
should you listen to me?
Why should we listen to you? Why should we believe you?
The reason you should listen to me is because there are people out there like me who are not reformed. And I know who they are. I've worked with those types of people before. And I'm telling you now that they don't care who they get money from. They will get money from whoever they need to. Now, why should you believe I'm reformed? You know what? You don't have to believe I'm reformed. The thing is that my history and my actions now will speak for themselves. I work every single day to protect people from the type of person I used to be.
Go into those rationalizations. Go into those rationalizations a little bit. The number of people you think that are out there doing these things, are they all in the same boat, just need a few extra bucks, or are they completely moral free? What's the common denominator?
It's the amoral type environment, or the situational ethics more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers of players, when Shadow Crew was shut down in 2004, that was the largest website of its type at that point, we ended with 4,000 members. 2017, the largest website that was shut down was called Alpha Bay. It had 240,000 members. 2 months ago, another website was shut down, 1.15 million registered criminals on the site. So these numbers continue to increase, and they're going to continue to increase because criminals, they see that, they see the profit that's being made, they don't really pay attention to the consequences, they just see the dollar amounts. At the same time, the internet allows that separation from your victim, so you don't have to look your victim in the face that you're taking advantage of.
And you think
so it makes it much easier to commit crime.
And you think about as the population of interested bodies grows, the likelihood of getting caught is smaller. So you think about all
Absolutely.
These, you know, if you have 1.4 million that are
1.15,
that's a part of this community,
mm-hmm.
the likelihood of you being able to make $10,000 or steal $10,000 or steal $50,000 and getting that being detected is slimmer. So
Absolutely.
You know, and everyone, we all do it. Maybe not over this, but we all do it. We speed and we rationalize. I'm a good driver.
I got to get there.
You know, and so it's the same thing. And so one of the things that I stopped doing years ago is when I started doing this kind of work is using the word criminal, because I don't want us to be able to put a fence between them and us. Because we all
there is
think
no fence.
There's no fence. It's an invisible fence, like an invisible dog fence. You know,
I don't know a lot of people who are immune to that. I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a very interesting. And earlier today, you said something about keeping a lying journal. The lie log.
Abby, I'm thinking about you, girl. The lie log.
I like that.
I mean, to this day, you consider yourself a reformed person, but you probably still do, Brett. Just lie once in a while, cheat a little bit here, speed.
I do speed.
Yeah.
But I admit it.
Absolutely. I'm curious about the timing, too. In 2007, we were leading up to a pretty good bubble burst. Did you have anything to do with that? Do you think that anything you did helped promote what happened in 2008-09?
No, I don't think. I think it was there's just the mentality of everyone at that point in time. And cybercrime, the criminals that were out there, self-included, we had that whole mindset of just more, more, more. And I think that was the entire society at that point. So you had the subprime loans that were going on, things like that. And certainly as criminals, we took advantage of that as well. But, that's the problem, right, is we're in a country now where everyone's an individual. Everyone is, it's all about me. Mm-hmm. It's not about me helping anyone else. It's about me. And when you're like that, when you adopt that type of philosophy, of course, things are going to go haywire. You're going to get a president like Trump.
You don't blame him. Like you think that. He's just a symptom of what's been developing over the years.
Absolutely is. Absolutely. If we had a proper society, a society of people that cared about one another, Donald Trump would not be sitting in the Oval Office today.
Well, you think about it. I think I'm still in my Diana Ross aura. I was at Diana Ross last night, and the last song she sung was Reach Out and Touch, Someone Leave to Make This World a Better Place. Everybody was just swaying in the audience, and I was like, we don't even hear music like that anymore.
No, we do not.
Or We Are the World. We don't even hear stuff like that anymore. It's all about what I bought, what I have, and it just, I'm just in
it's
my
It's not day. Getting any better.
It's not getting any better.
Brett, thank you so much for your frankness and for your work. I consider you a good
thank
guy,
you.
A white hat, and I'm gonna take your advice. I'm going to freeze my credit. I actually have already frozen it because I had a little issue not too long ago. So I froze my credit. I check regularly everything I do. What was the third one we got to do?
Ask him to find out if you're on the
Password manager,
dark.
Freeze credit, monitor account.
Password manager. You need to let her know if she's on the dark web.
Yeah, really. We're going to talk later. I got your number.
I hear me, she is.
I am not happy. Brett, thank you again for your call. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Have a good evening.
You too. Brett Johnson is a convicted white-collar cyber, not criminal. We're not going to do that. We're going to say...
Person.
He's a cyber person, but who was once on the U.S. Secret Service Most Wanted list.
Here not on. Everybody makes that list, right?
No, everybody does. Croc Obama. You heard of the names? The humble gator, Croc Obama. That's her favorite. I don't know. I like Rod Blagojevich, too. That was a good one. Richard J. Scaly. They get better. Wait a second. Noam Chomsky? Chomp-ski. Sorry, didn't say it right. Ray Kroc. And Chance the Snapper. Chance the Snapper. Good names. Good names. You got one, Ashley? No? Okay. You look like you were about to give me one.
Somebody said Wally. It wasn't really a pun one, but I thought that one was funny.
Wally's nice. Yeah.
Well, there's the old cartoon, Wally Gator.
Oh, that's why. Thank you, Roger. That's why you're there with the news, making sure we've got it all straight. So we've been talking about crime all night long, and I haven't even mentioned a friend of mine who's a shoplifter. I never even got to it. And the guilt of knowing it and not doing anything about it, because, God, I could never do anything about it. How could I ever do anything like that? All I can do is say, oh, you shouldn't do that. That's all I can do.
So you would never be a whistleblower?
I would. That's a good question. It depends on for what, for who, how large. I know. You start doing the rationalizations. I have rationalized away worrying about a friend who's shoplifting.
You know, there's something we talk about in my class called the fraud triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity, pressure, rationalization.
Opportunity, pressure.
Rationalization. So you can think about every crime in that way. So you think about Jason's story. His opportunity was he owned his own business. He directly interacted with someone that had access to create these invoices and approve them.
Mm-hmm.
His pressure was he just wanted more. Maybe mm-hmm. just greed.
Mm-hmm.
And his rationalization, I can do it.
I can. They should work on that because I can.
Yeah. And so there's a whistleblowing triangle that uses the same thing, opportunity, pressure, rationalization. And that's what you just went through.
I sure
did. Those are the three things you just did when you were like, depends on for who, how, you know. That's,
are we in the store? Is he doing it right this second? Is someone looking at me? Do I have someone approaching me to ask?
What's your opportunity to do it? Do you have to call? Do you have to talk to someone? Maybe can you do it confidentially or anonymously? What's your rationalization as to why you should do it? Like, why do I care? Does it impact me? Does it impact someone, friend or family? And then the pressure is, what's the guilt if I don't do it?
Right. And then you mentioned that life has changed quite a bit. And the anonymity of cybercrime is very appealing, I'm sure, to those who do. But they're wrecking lives.
Well, but something that there's a lot of research that talks about that puts the distance between the victim and the money. And so cyber allows you to do that in a way that embezzlement or violent crimes or just taking someone's handbag and running off with it, that's very different. But taking money out of someone's bank account
directly
puts no face to it.
No.
You don't think of, and then you think, oh, it's insured.
Yeah.
What difference does it make?
Right. Now, it may not be, A, and B, it probably isn't. If it's coming out of your checking account, it comes off your credit card. We love Visa. Well, they'll take anything off and they just take it. I wonder what the dollar amount is per year that our country loses. Did we hear that number tonight at all?
We can just say trillions.
Just trillions. I mean, seriously, it probably is. And as we learned from Brett, we are all on the dark web. I mean, it just is.
He showed me mine.
Really?
It was $2.99 for a sale. It was discounted. That's how terrible I am.
Because your bank account was a little low that day. Tomorrow, ask her again when she gets paid. Wow, you saw it.
Oh, I saw it, yeah. I saw it. He showed it to me.
So it's just chance that you aren't being activated.
It's just chance I haven't been picked.
Right? It is that. It's just chance. And, of course, not doing the things that he said. Checking your accounts. Everyone that you have.
Well, freezing your child is a big one.
Freeze your credit.
What he talks about is how a child, when they were 9 and then went, they were 16 or 17 and tried to apply for a credit card and their whole life was wrecked. And they never knew it. Because why would they? And so it's when you go and apply for credit and you realize you're screwed.
Now, what's the upshot of that? This 18-year-old goes and says, that ain't me.
You got to fight. I mean,
you have to prove that it's not you.
You have to prove, yeah. Because why would someone believe that it wasn't?
Right. Yeah, why wouldn't they? You want to have to go bankrupt just to prove that. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes that real estate, that I asked Brett whether or not he thought he was part of the bubble and creating some of the financial struggles, being part of that. He was involved with the Russians, he said, so why not? But I think real estate in itself was criminal at that time. We were kind of victimized by it.
Sure.
We made some good money, my husband and I, poor money. Bad money, and a little more money. Oh, look at that. We're doing okay. We're on an upswing. And they said, oh, upswing. I can get you in that house. I can get you in there. They said, I can't believe how many times I heard them say, we can get you in there. Yeah, well, you can, but can I stay? What if my year isn't quite that good the next day or next year?
But that's when you have to say, well, your inner voice has to speak up. You know, it's almost like when we smoke, we know what's in cigarettes, but it's us. We have to decide.
Make that decision. Yeah, it's been an incredible conversation. I've really enjoyed this. I'm Catherine Lake with Kelly Richmond Pope. We've been talking about real crime and white-collar crime. Now, we haven't pivoted, and we've left this for the last 2 minutes here, but white-collar can become red-collar. Things can go real bad.
Let me tell you what it is quickly.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a lot of collar colors tonight, right?
Yes.
There's white, there's red, there's blue, there's also pink. Pink is women that embezzle.
Really?
But when we talk about red collar crime, what that is, it's a term that was developed by a friend and colleague of mine at another university. His name is Dr. Richard Brody. And it's when white collar crime results in murder.
Mm.
And so what happens is, if I think you're stealing, and I approach you, you might get so nervous that you might kill me.
I could.
Just to keep me quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's these fascinating cases. And when we think about this whole concept of true crime, a lot of it is dealing in murder and serial killers. Like, that's really where it started from. But a lot of times there's a financial story in these.
Just starts so innocently.
It starts so innocently. I mean, people panic. You panic. I mean, if you think about some of the cases that we'll talk another time.
Mm.
But some of these cases are about a person who stole someone's identity and then that person discovered it, or they thought the person was going to discover it. And so instead, they just kill them, shoot them. They dismember their bodies. They chop them up. You know, just you would not believe it.
Accountants
that kill or get killed.
So it's not like the Jason Bateman movie when he goes and gets Kathy, what's her name, and catches her and she's funny. No, that's not the way it goes sometimes.
Nah.
It goes badly.
Quickly.
Well, you are brilliant. I want to sing you All the Queen's Horses. It's your movie that you made, a documentary about the woman in Dixon who stole all that money and bought a bunch of horses. And it's brilliant. And you can find it on Amazon Prime. That's where I saw it today.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
It's iTunes.
Amazon,
or YouTube.
All the Queen's Horses. Yeah. We'll tell you that whole story about Dixon. And you teach at DePaul.
Well, come on over.
Come on over and take a class.